At four. We're going to call this meeting Elections Committee to order, and I believe that we barely have quorum. We have four individuals, so that gives that to us. And has Representative Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, just a point of order. I'm not sure who's here. I see you're here. I see the Vice Chair is here. Representative Bernardi is here. I'm here. That's four of eight. We would need to have five, if I'm not mistaken. Am I missing somebody?
No, you're not missing anybody. We will count eight.
Well, you just by house rules can't go ahead and start doing business and doing votes and stuff. You certainly have the ability to be able to start hearings and stuff, but to officially call the meeting to order, one needs a quorum to do that.
Well, I would retract that call.
Just from somebody who's been in the seat that you're in.
No, I'm
happy to help with the procedural things.
Totally understand that. Appreciate that. But we're going to get started, and we'll have our first testifier come forward.
And Mr. Chair, when it's appropriate, I do have some procedural questions I'd like to visit with you and the committee about relative to the bills and what we're going to be doing here today.
Sounds good.
And going forward. Thank you.
Okay. Yep. So House File 94, Representative Vang, if you'd like to come forward and start your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Let me get myself situated here. So this is my...
Let's move your bill. We can't move your bill, so we'll start with your testimony, and when we get quorum, we will actually move the bill before the...
There you go.
Okay. Well, I do have some treats, considering this is my first bill hearing, so I will hand this over to the committee page to pass it out. These are treats that from my district, my local Asian grocery store, and snacks that me and my siblings grew up eating at, so I hope you guys enjoy them. So thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Samantha Vang, Representative Vang. HF 94 entails amending Minnesota Statute 204C15, striking off the language on limiting voter assistance at the ballot box up to three people. My background, I have spent years doing election work, from an election judge to organizing nonpartisan voter engagement work through nonprofits and community organizations. My direct experience have found this law to disproportionately hurt communities with limited English proficiency and those with disabilities. We all know that the 15th Amendment guarantees citizens of the United States the right to vote. However, I'm sure you're all aware that in our history, communities of colors have been discriminated against from voting. Thus, the Voting Rights Act was established to prevent legal barriers at the state and local level from preventing underrepresented communities the right to vote. Unfortunately, this Minnesota statute violates the Voting Rights Act, particularly Section 208, which states, the VRA provides for voters who need assistance to vote by reason of blindness, disability, or inability to read or write. Any such voter may be given assistance by a person of the voter's choice other than the voter's employer or agent of the employer or officer or agent of the voter's union. This Minnesota law limiting voter assistance up to three people violates the voter's choice when a scenario such as simply bringing my parents and my grandparents, who also don't speak English, to the polls and having to make a choice of leaving one of them out. In my years of doing election work, I've heard stories from underrepresented communities, how difficult it is for them to vote simply because there's a language barrier, or how unfamiliar and uncomfortable the process was for them. This is unsettling when our democracy depends on citizens being guaranteed the right to vote. If Secretary of State Steve Simon is here, I hope he will also give his statement on the current updates and what options we have looking ahead.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Secretary. Say your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, this, I think, is an important bill. And I came in a little bit late, so I didn't hear all of what Representative Vang had to say, but I assume she laid out pretty generally the lay of the land and statute that we have a three-person limit. I don't know if she said this, but there's only one other state in the country, and that state is Arkansas, that has any numerical limit of this kind. But I'm here to just not repeat what Representative Vang said, but to add another dimension for your consideration, and that is that if we don't repeal this law, it may be repealed, in effect, for us at considerable expense. Here's what I mean. Our office was contacted in 2017 about a potential lawsuit stemming from this provision. And what strengthens any potential lawsuit is the fact that there was an analogous, not identical, but analogous decision from a federal court in Texas in 2017, which said that this provision, Section 208 of the Voting Rights Act, applied to a Texas law that also limited the choice of a voter in foreign language or disability assistance at the polling place. And the court said, and Texas didn't even appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court. They just stood down after this case, which is pretty unusual. And the court said, no, you can't do that. The Voting Rights Act is very specific that the voter gets his or her choice of who they assist, who assists them. And so if they want the assistance of someone who has already assisted three people, in Minnesota, they wouldn't have their choice of person. In Texas, in case you're wondering, the Texas case, again, analogous but not the same. The Texas case was a challenge to a Texas law that said if you're going to be assisted in the polling place, it has to be someone registered to vote in that county. And so a woman from India originally, but a U.S. citizen for a long time, who had some language difficulties, wanted a relative, I can't remember whether it was a son or a son-in-law, somebody, a relative to come in and assist her. But that relative was not registered to vote in that county. He was registered to vote, but not in the county. The court said unanimously, the federal court, you can't do that. Section 208 of the Voting Rights Act says that if you need assistance by reason of disability or language barrier, that you get the person of your choosing. And so I guess the bottom line is this, if I had to be just blunt about it, I think we can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way. The easy way is to pass this bill and get this antiquated law off the books that only one other state, Arkansas, has. Or we can do it the hard way, which is not repeal this law, be sued, pretty good chance we lose, incur a bunch of attorney's fees, and have a court tell us to repeal a law. I think that's the choice before us. So even members, if you weren't wild about the law on its merits, I think from the standpoint of litigation protection, it's fairly likely that, I mean, I've given up a long time ago predicting what courts are going to do, so nothing's a slam dunk, of course, but my assessment would be there is a reasonable chance, especially based on this Texas case, that a court is going to make us do it, only we'll be a lot poorer at the end of the process, and we'll have a court telling us what to do rather than just doing it voluntarily.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Members, we will move into questions now. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam. Excuse me. Thank you. My brain is still frozen.
Yeah, I think we're all a little bit slow this morning.
Yeah. So. Maybe the Senate was smarter to postpone business for today. Maybe they are the smarter body today, at least. Mr. Chair, a couple of questions for the Secretary relative to this. The lawsuit that you're referring to that strikes down what you're talking about with Minnesota language, assistance by a person, and I'm talking in the court's ruling on this, assistance by a person of the voter's choice, are there any parameters whatsoever, or is it literally prima facie the voter's choice?
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll. You know, I'm not an expert in that strand of case law on Section 208, but it seems to be pretty broad. And so I don't know. I mean, a lawsuit, to be candid, a lawsuit in Minnesota suing Minnesota on the basis of this law would be a test case. You know, what does that mean? What restrictions can a state impose? For example, I'm sure if the person of choice were a four-year-old, I would imagine, again, I've sort of given up predicting, but I would imagine it's certainly reasonable that a court might say, okay, person, there are some limitations here. We're not going to allow a four-year-old to go into the polling place. But the court in Texas did say that you can't say that if you demand that the person who's providing assistance be a registered voter in that county, that goes too far. Similarly here, I'm guessing, and certainly there's a group of plaintiffs out there that are on the edge of suing the state of Minnesota, are saying that if you say that just because they've helped three people, that they're unavailable to be the choice of somebody in the polls, again, hard to say. This is why, you know, lawyers try the cases, but I think there's a reasonable likelihood that a court would conclude on that basis that our law goes too far in terms of Section 208 of the vote. But I can't say that for sure. I would be foolish to say it's a slam dunk, but I think there's a reasonable likelihood of that happening.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Secretary, so, you know, a person who is a registered voter in that precinct, your point of a four-year-old, that's what I'm looking at, is it because of prima facie, you know, a person of the voter's choice, that's very broad. And the question, I guess, would be, and maybe Mr. Gehring can help us with some of this as well, but my question would be, does that person have to be a registered voter, a citizen of the United States? Do we have any parameters on that whatsoever to be able to have some safeguards to, again, a person of your choice? And what I understand Representative Vang's bill is doing is it's just actually asking us to strike the maximum number of persons. And I see two tracks on this. One, the maximum number of persons because a person of their choice. So if I happen to be number four in the scenario that Representative Vang is bringing forward, I'm out of luck if that person's already assisted three other people. The track that I want to pursue with you that we may need to have clarification on is, what does it mean in the state of Minnesota, a person of your choice? And Mr. Chair, if you would like to comment, and maybe Mr. Gehring from House Research can help us on that too.
Mr. Secretary,
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, yeah, I don't know, and I don't know if that would be really a matter of sort of federal case law, I would imagine, on the, you know, the breadth of Section 208. I just don't know, but the Texas case was sort of the case that started this also. I don't know what federal, and that's, again, it's the federal statute. I don't know what the cases have said about what conditions are okay. Mr. Gehring, I don't know if you know
Mr.
either.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, so in the Federal Voting Rights Act, the two limitations that are explicitly authorized are prohibiting a voter's employer or union agent to assist the voter, but otherwise there's no clarity in the federal law about other types of restrictions. I think this Texas case is the only one, that at least the only one that I'm aware of, where this type of challenge has been raised. So I think, as Secretary Simon said, that it's probably up to interpret if the state were to impose some other type of restriction, like on age or something like that, it might be open to a challenge, but we don't quite know, except beyond this Texas case, what the court would say about that.
Mr. O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gehring, thank you for that. It seems like the issue is bigger than striking one sentence that's found on lines 1.16 and 1.17 in House File 94 is being offered by Representative Vang here today. Mr. Chair, we're not planning on voting this today, are we?
Representative O'Driscoll, I believe that we are planning on voting on it and re-referring it to government operations.
Mr. Chair, if this is an appropriate time, I had indicated earlier that I have some questions procedurally about what we're going to be doing. And if this is not the right time, but it sort of seems when you said we're going to be voting this out, just maybe to pursue that if it's okay with you.
Proceed.
Sir, thank you, Mr. Chair. Previously, under the House rules and the structure that we had, the Government Operations and Election Committee was one, and now we've kind of put this oversight of some of our members who are going to get a chance to vote on a lot of different things that are on the Ways and Means Committee, while others of us aren't going to be able to have the opportunity to create bills. And by that I mean we've put together omnibus bills in the Elections Committee previously, and I was just wondering if it's going to be your intention or your ability with the new structure to be able to create omnibus bills in the Elections Committee, vote those out, and move those in a process, and if so, how would that process work?
Thank you, Representative. I believe our situation is going to be we will do some comprehensive bills, and I've spoken to the lead in the other body, and my hope is that we'll be able to package two of them, one where we will have stuff we all sort of agree upon, things that I think are going to be easy, and another one which may have several other policies or other things that may come together from which we would then start moving it forward in the House and then see what happens with what they move forward in the Senate and begin negotiations on what that might look like. But my hope is that we'll pass a bill that we all agree is some of the more technical stuff and some of the stuff that we know we need to do. And in the end, we may have something that might have a little bit more controversy associated with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up?
Yes.
So House File 94 is or is not one of those bills that you would look to be putting in one of the two bills, that omnibus bills that you're suggesting today?
Yeah, I think, Representative, we will probably move a few of these bills on their own. And then as the session moves on, we may be laying those over for possible inclusion.
So, then, Mr. Chair, if they're out of the division's jurisdiction, because they went back to Ways and Means, would they be then referred back to the Elections Committee for its work, or would another committee assume the work of the Elections Committee at that point?
Just to be sure, Representative, are you talking about House File 94 and 45 today, or are you talking about other bills that may come in the future?
Yes. I'm just trying to understand the new
structure.
This is my fifth term, and it's all new to me, and I'm just trying to understand the new structure, Mr. Chair, and I don't mean anything malicious.
Sure,
truly
sure.
Don't. Just trying to understand, because we've got this division. I've been involved in elections. Now Secretary Simon was Chair Simon of the Elections Committee. I understood when that was taken away from and broken off from government operations, how that worked, because it was under the traditional structure of the state. If, as a member, I don't understand, how am I ever going to be able to explain that to people who are constituents of mine or others who have an interest in this? If I can't say, I don't know what's going to happen. It might get moved back. It might be made by another committee. We're voting some bills out, some bills no. I guess I'm just looking for kind of some housekeeping rules and some intentions about what we'd be thinking of doing. And maybe we don't have those answers, because right. It's maybe we just haven't dealt with this new structure long enough to know.
Sure, Representative, I believe that we will have some bills that will move independently. And like I said, my hope is that we'll have a bill that will include a lot of things that we all agree upon. And then we'll probably have something that may be more omnibus that will have some things we don't agree upon. So where a particular bill is going to land is still to be seen. And that's sort of the thing that we'll figure out as we go along. What are those appropriate bills to be placed where?
Just two other things, Mr. Chair. One is a follow-up on that, and then another is on a different topic. To that point, in the past, we've had governors who, going back to Tim Pawlenty, his 8 years as governor, Governor Dayton, his 8 years as governor, so 16 years, you know, maybe a little bit short of a generation of history in this state, where we've tried to pass out of the House and the Senate strong bipartisanly supported bills that dealt with campaign finance reform and dealt with elections reform. And having been the chief author of those two bills the past few sessions, I took that charge very seriously to work with my counterparts to be able to make sure that we had those bills that were strong bipartisanly supported. To my best of my knowledge, Governor Walz has not given any kind of an indication whether he tends to want to keep with that history of what previous governors have done to instill confidence in and to also instill trust by the Minnesota people in the process, on the legislative process. Is it your intention to try to work on bipartisan related legislation and information as a chair, in keeping with that theme that other chairs have done in the past as well?
Representative Driscoll, of course it's my intention to try to work in a bipartisan manner. I have not taken a stance on we would need to have bipartisan support within a committee to move a bill out of committee. It's my philosophy that given that the Senate is a Republican majority, that any bill that we pass that happens to make it through the Senate as well would go to the governor, would have bipartisan support.
And again, there is no statutory definition of strong bipartisan support. It's in the eyes of the beholder.
Yes.
And maybe that's good, so that both parties, the legislative and the administrative, are working in with the most due diligence as possible. The other point is we do not have a majority, so you can go ahead and convene the meeting and bring the bill officially in front of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. We will now call the meeting to order with quorum, and I will move House File 94 to be re-referred to.
I do have one more testifier that
Yeah, we will get back to you. re-refer to government operations. Representative Vang, if you want to call together your next testifier.
Yes. I will act as his interpreter.
Great. Representative Vang, if you could have him state his name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ning Hyung. I am a staff and member of the SGU, the Secret Guerrilla Unit. It's a soldiers, veterans who helped U.S. allies during the Vietnam War. We recognize that this law makes it harder for our veterans to go out and vote. There are many barriers that face our older veterans. Part of it is transportation, language barrier. And so we hope that you guys will recognize the difficulty of these barriers for us and repeal this law. Thank you. That is all.
Thank you. Questions, members? Yes, Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say Na Zhang, and thank you for your testimony.
If there's no other questions, I actually do have a question regarding the bill, Representative Vang. Your bill is only for physical assistance. It has nothing to do with impacting the number of people in which an individual could vouch for any of those types of provisions under our current statutes.
Yes. So this is only assistance at the ballot box. Anything outside of the ballot box is not included in this.
Okay. Seeing
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just want to follow up on your question. And I may have misinterpreted or not heard the whole thing, but it does deal with how many people can assist with elections because we're removing the cap and threshold of three. So, in fact, it does affect the number of persons that can be assisted. Yeah, it doesn't affect people that are assisted. Or did I misinterpret the comment?
I believe I said vouching.
Yeah, vouching is not at all.
Not at all.
Perfect. Okay. Yeah, yep. Yeah, yeah. Thank you for the clarification, sir.
Yep. Seeing no other questions, we will vote to move this and re-refer it to government operations. Oh, we have public testimony? Oh, okay. Well, we will hold off on that vote and public testimony. Individuals, please come down, sir, and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Well, good morning, Chairman Dean and members of the Subcommittee on Elections and Representative Vang. My name is Gene Martinez. I'm a senior advocate with the ARC Minnesota, and we're a statewide advocacy organization that protects the human rights of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and actively supporting them and their families in a lifetime of full inclusion and participation in the communities. I am here today to testify in support of House File 94, one of the civil rights that our organization has worked hard to promote and protect is the right for individuals with disabilities to vote. For members of the disability community, voting provides a sense of pride, knowing that they are able to cast a ballot for a candidate who shares their vision for the community, and knowing that they play a role in shaping the legislature in our state. However, for people with intellectual and disabilities, developmental disabilities, overcoming barriers to fulfill the civil right to vote is still a constant challenge. In 2016, people with disabilities accounted for 35 million eligible voters in the United States, but less than half participated in the election. Voters with disabilities still face many barriers at the polls due to physical inaccessibility, not having access to register to vote, and sometimes election workers questioning their capacity. Numerous people have had their right to vote challenged because of cognitive disabilities, even though it does not prevent them from making an educated, independent choice for candidates. With House File 94, we have an opportunity to eliminate at least one barrier to voting and expand the options available to individuals with disabilities in selecting a person of their choice to help mark their ballot when necessary. The present restriction on the number of voters whom an individual can support in marking a ballot concerns us for three primary reasons. It limits the assistance that individuals with disabilities can receive from trusted direct support professionals. It restricts the individual's right to choose who to assist them in marking their ballot, and in the most egregious instances, may limit their ability to vote altogether. There does not seem to be any rational reason for limiting the assistance to only three people, so we support House File 94 that eliminates any restrictions on the number of people that can be assisted in marking their ballot, and I urge the Subcommittee on Elections to support this bill as well. Thank you to Representative Vang for championing this issue, and thanks very much to the Chair and the Subcommittee, and I'm available for any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Martinez. And members, any questions? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Martinez. First of all, I just want to thank you for your testimony and for being a voice for people with disabilities. I think that we have seen here at the Capitol the impact that people with disabilities have on public policy, and that this is a community that's been very active in public policy over the last many years. And I know that there's an important phrase, not about us, without us, that is part of disability policymaking, and that's often in my mind as a policymaker. So the opportunity to vote for, you know, working people in many cases to vote is really important, and protecting that for everybody is important. And I think that these are stories that we don't always get to hear. So thank you for that. One question that I have, and you may or may not know the answer because the Olmstead decision is very complex, but how does being able to participate in elections and vote kind of line up with the Olmstead decision that people with disabilities have the right to self-determination in any and all forms?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Dean, Representative Halverson, I think it's implicit in the Olmstead decision because people are entitled to live their lives in the most integrated setting possible and to participate in the life of the community. And I don't think that there's any more central participation value, at least from a civic standpoint, than the right to vote. So I think Olmstead is part of the overall historical push to involve people with disabilities in their community to their maximum capacity, and certainly voting goes hand in hand with accomplishing that.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I just want to underscore for the committee, who don't spend a lot of time in the health and human services space, that the Olmstead decision actually requires all of us as policymakers to put the self-determination of people with disabilities primary in our policymaking. So I think that that's really important for us to consider as we consider Representative Vang's proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Martinez. Any other questions? Great. Seeing as we have a break here before introduction of our next bill. Two orders of business. I'm sorry. Were there any other testifiers? Yes, I'm sorry. Okay. Say your name for the record and please proceed.
My name is Frances Hall, and I am a licensed practical nurse and have been for over 20 years. I work in the home care sector with disabled clients. I also am the leader for Asian Pacific Islanders in Minnesota, partnered with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. And so I'm here to testify that on partner with the other gentleman, we have, in the state of Minnesota, we have over 600,000 people with disabilities. And with the bill that is now in place, that leaves approximately one-third of those eligible voters not able to be able to vote, which is about 200,000. As far as the Asian Pacific Islander group, there are 151,000 eligible Asian Pacific Islander voters in Minnesota, and there is a 91% growth rate since 2000. We have actually Asian Pacific Islanders, there's over a million APIs living in Minnesota, and there are 45% of them, which is over a half a million, that do not speak or write English. And so I am in support of changing this, because in the federal law states that you can only get assistance in marking a ballot. It doesn't limit how many people can assist you at the polls as far as translating. In the Minnesota bill, it limits the person to be able to translate to three people, period, and or mark ballots. And to me, I think that's a shame, because we're leaving out a lot of people in the state of Minnesota, and, you know, half of the eligible API voters live in the Tri-City area. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Any questions? Great. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other individuals who would like to testify? Okay. With that, we will proceed to refer this to government operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Okay. The motion carries. Before we move to House File 45, a couple things. We have some minutes to approve. Representative Bonner, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, so moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. That is passed. And before Representative Schultz comes down, I'd like our two pages to introduce themselves, Ben and Emily, if you could stand up and tell us who you are and where you're from and how excited you are to be here.
I'm Emily. I'm from Bloomington, Minnesota, and I'm super excited to be here. I just graduated from Poly Sci. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
I'm Ben. I live in the Highland Park area. I'm pretty excited to be here, although I will admit the cold did put a little bit of a damper on this morning.
Well, thank you both for coming in. With that, Representative Schultz, if you'd like to come down. And Representative Halverson, would you like to move her bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 45 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Thank you. Your bill is before us. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm presenting House File 45. It's referred to as the Automatic Voter Registration Bill, but it's not necessarily automatic. It does streamline the voter registration process by allowing individuals the opportunity to register to vote when they fill out an application for a driver's license or a learner's permit or an identification card when they're applying for a new license or renewing a license. So 15 states plus the District of Columbia have, with bipartisan support, have authorized automatic voter registration bills with great success in registering individuals. I believe Oregon was the first state, and they've really increased the number of people who are registered to vote. This process makes voting more efficient. It reduces lines at the polling locations. So it's doesn't deter voters if they see long lines, so it reduces those lines. It also improves the transmission of accurate information, moving away from paper documentation to electronic transfer of information by updating addresses. You are currently allowed to an opt-in system when you apply for a driver's license or renew a license or identification card. This process would make it an opt-out, and according to behavioral economic research, you're going to get much higher participation with an opt-out system than an opt-in system. I also want to bring your attention to a recent study that was conducted in 2018 that will be released in next month, February of this year. It was funded by the McKnight, Joyce, and Kresge Foundation. And this was brought to my attention by Bob Tracy from the Minnesota Council on Foundations. And they did a study of voting behavior and attitudes in the Great Lakes region, initiated the study in 2018. But they found that 64% of Minnesota voters support automatic voter registration. And this includes support across all demographics and survey measures, including race, gender, age, and party. So regardless of what national political parties believe, the broader public supports increased voter access, not less. So at this time, I know I have a lot of testifiers here. I'd like to bring down the Secretary of State, Steve Simon, to testify, and then the other testifiers, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Thank you, Representative. Members, I think it might be best to get through the testifiers and then move into questions. So Secretary Simon, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I want to thank Representative Schultz for being a champion on this issue. I'll try to avoid repeating what she said. It'll be hard because she did a very good job of covering, I think, what needs to be covered. But let me just say, in some sense, as she sort of indicated, there's less here than meets the eye. You hear something called automatic voter registration. It has this sweeping connotation of some massive change to the system. But really, it's a gloss on what we already have. We have a motor voter law, like almost every state does. Right now, when you go in and get or renew a driver's license or a state ID, as the case may be, you take the iChart test, and there's a box on the form that you check if you want to be registered to vote. It's an opt-in. This would just change that to an opt-out. So all the steps that a prospective voter goes through to register to vote, the only one that is being changed here is step one. The long list of 10 or a dozen things that happen, steps 2 through 12 are still the same. It's just step one. Nothing is different, and there's nothing particularly automatic about it. It's not like something happens and a computer works its magic and someone's automatically registered. That's not the case now. It wouldn't be the case under this bill. It's just changing the presumption. One other bit that I wanted to add that I don't think was mentioned earlier is has to do with same-day voter registration. It's no secret that there are folks out there who have been maybe skeptical is not the right word, but have some concerns about same day or election day voter registration. If any legislator is in that camp, if any legislator believes that there's cause for concern or to be nervous about same day or election day voter registration, wouldn't it be better to get everyone or nearly everyone in the system before election day so that far fewer people are relying on same day election registration? Just to give you a statistic, in 2018 on election day, we had over 130,000 eligible Minnesotans registered to vote on Election Day using a driver's license, Minnesota ID, or receipt of one of those. So the actual number of same-day registrants was higher. But if you just take those who registered just this last November, it's 130,000 people. So if there are legislators here, or just for the record, who have concerns about same-day voter registration for whatever reason, wouldn't you want a system that would probably, I'm guessing, cut down by 90% or more the number of people who are registering on election? Isn't that something that we would all maybe want? I'm not trying to undercut same-day voter registration. I think it's a cornerstone of our system, and I would fight any attempt to roll it back. But there have been discussions in the House and in the Senate and in this legislature about some people's reservations about election day registration. All the more reason, don't you want people in their daily life to be in the system earlier so you can do the earlier filtering and screening and checking? Isn't that something that we should all want, though we do provide this very important convenience of same-day voter registration. So I think that accounts for why this is more and more a totally nonpartisan issue. 15 states and the District of Columbia have already passed it, and that's just in the last 4 or 5 years since it sort of became a concept. And it's been bipartisan in states like Alaska, in states like Nevada, in states like Illinois, where the Republican governor signed it into law after extensive negotiations. So that's a piece that I don't think has been said that I just wanted to add to. This can really be a win-win. There are reasons to do it, which have as their advantage cleaning up the voter rolls, making them more accurate and arguably more reliable. And I think that's the piece that I wanted to emphasize. So thank you, members. I appreciate your consideration.
And thank you, Mr. Secretary. And I'm assuming you'll stick around for questions.
I will.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to now call down Kathy Tomsis and Nick Harper from the League of Women Voters. If you're here, please come down. State your name for the record, and please proceed.
My name is Kathy Tomsich.
My name is Nick Harper. I'm the Civic Engagement Director for the League of Women Voters, and Kathy will be delivering our testimony today. I'm just here for questions.
Okay, proceed.
Yes. I'm here on behalf of the League of Women Voters Minnesota. I also serve as a head election judge for Ramsey County. The League is proud to be nonpartisan. We neither support nor oppose candidates or political parties at any level of government. We work to ensure that all eligible citizens have access to the ballot box. And of course, in order to vote, you need to register. The League supports House File 45 because it streamlines the existing registration process. In 2018, the legislative auditor issued a report on registration, on voter registration, that examined the challenges the county election officials have in creating and maintaining accurate voter registration records. It also pointed out the crucial role that the Department of Public Safety plays in these efforts. The Department of Public Safety currently, as pointed out before, collects the data required for voter registration and electronically transmits this data to the Secretary of State for people who opt in when they apply or renew a driver's license or a state ID. The streamlined process in House File 45 would be a small expansion of the existing process. It will not be a large step to go from where we are now to where we would like to be. This, I'd like to emphasize that this is not mandatory registration. There's always the opt-out option. But eligible voters can move more easily, can more easily register to vote. It's certainly much easier to do it this way than election day registration, where I have seen people stand in long lines at the registration table. Registration applications from the DMV are more accurate than paper registrations. Processing the paper registrations is costly and labor-intensive, often due to illegible writing and incomplete information. The auditor's report states that over a recent two-year period, approximately 57% of the registrations that were of new Minnesota registrants were submitted on paper. Here. House File 45 saves on average $3.54 in labor costs per paper application. And that is stated in the handout that you received, and it indicates the source for that labor cost savings. This bill would result in a reduction of the number of paper applications, therefore a reduction in processing costs and increased accuracy. I urge you to support House File 45.
Thank you, Ms. Tomsic. And I'm assuming that we're going to wait for questions, so unless you have anything to ask Mr. Harper at this time, we'll proceed on to the next testifier. George Beck. Welcome, and please state your name and for the record and proceed.
Chair Dean, members, my name is George Beck. I chair Minnesota Citizens for Clean Elections, and I am a former chair of the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board. I'm here this morning to urge you to construct a dome over the Twin Cities. No, wait a minute. I got that wrong. I'm testifying in support of House File 45 because I think our current system of registration is onerous compared to other states. It stands as an unnecessary obstacle to access to the ballot. It should be easy to vote. 15 states and the District of Columbia have adopted this policy, which means that a third of Americans are automatically registered to vote. In Oregon, registration rates have quadrupled since AVR was adopted in 2016. This policy will keep voter rolls more accurate with continuous updates and fewer errors. It will save money on printing, mailing, and data entry. As has been mentioned, registration is not compulsory. You can opt out. The bill will improve democracy in Minnesota and help to combat voter suppression. I hope you will vote in favor of this bill, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beck, and I hope that you'll be able to stick around, too, if individuals have questions. And now I have on the list someone from Common Cause. Is there someone from Common Cause to testify? If not, we will move on to Max Halperin. Welcome, Mr. Halperin. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Max Halperin, and I will be testifying as an individual today. I imagine that there are members who came here to the hearing already inclined to think of automatic voter registration as a good idea, and there may be more skeptical members who think it could be an unwise idea. What I'd like to ask is that everyone, enthusiasts and skeptics alike, not think about it as an idea, but think about it as a component, as part of the broader registration system, along with other components, including online registration and especially election day registration. The key point I want to make is that it should not be evaluated in isolation based on the positive or perhaps not as positive impact it would have on the registration rolls, but rather in an interactive sense, how does it impact the overall quality of the entire registration system, including the other components. And in particular, in Minnesota, unlike in some other states, the biggest effect would not be on bringing in a broader group of voters. The biggest effect, which has been alluded to by prior testifiers, would be a substantial reduction in the use of Election Day registration. And, you know, I need to say, Election Day registration is itself a valuable component of our registration system and would remain a valuable component even if it were much less routinely used, because its value comes not from the frequency with which it's used, but rather from the fact that it's a very general purpose tool that Minnesotans have available to address a wide range of different circumstances they find themselves in. I know that you heard from Representative O'Driscoll at a prior meeting that he recently had recourse to Election Day registration as a workaround for an administrative difficulty that really should never have arisen in the first place, but that unfortunately did. And I think we can take away from his story 2 points. One is that the primary objective should be to have such a well-designed, smoothly functioning system in place to handle routine registration business that most voters, most of the time, will have a trouble-free voting experience. Not what he experienced. But that then second, we should retain Election Day registration for those less common circumstances where it nonetheless proves necessary. I am remarking that Election Day registration would be greatly reduced. The idea there is straightforward, that if you get more registration done ahead of Election Day, there's less left to do on Election Day. I made a similar point, those of you with long memories may recall, in 2014 when this body was considering bills that would have authorized or did authorize online registration and multi-state data sharing consortium. And at that time, I expressed the hope that those technological improvements in advance registration would reduce Election Day registration. And I think it's fair 5 years later for you to ask me, what about that hope of yours? Was it realized? And I do have a PhD in number crunching, so I crunched the numbers. And there's a handout in your packet with the summertime photo of me on it that goes into somewhat more depth on those numbers, provides a graphical display of them. But the short version is, yeah, that hope was realized in spades, that in the last two elections, the 2016-2018 elections, we saw substantially fewer, like 350,000 fewer Election Day registrants than what we would have historically expected. And that's, you know, hats off to you and the legislature. That is something you as a body achieved through the reforms you put in place in 2014. And so the question now is, can you do that again? And so, yeah, again, there's a number. And that number is that even after those 350,000 were removed, the remaining Election Day voters, Election Day registrants, rather, 72% of them in 2016, I think it was a little lower in 2018, but similar, were, as the Secretary said, using a current driver's license or other card from the Driver and Vehicle Services as their proof of residence. So the majority of even the remaining Election Day registrants could be obviated if you were to pass this bill. And so that's why I ask all of you, the skeptics included, to support this bill as a reasonable measure to bring Minnesota the rest of the way to that state where all the routine registration business is smoothly handled ahead of Election Day, and only the much smaller group of unusual cases is left for Election Day registration. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Halperin. And if you could stick around, possible questions, we would appreciate it. Next, I'll call up Donna McNamara, if she is here. Okay, if not, Deborah Forsick, you could come down. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. And if you could try to keep it to under 5 minutes so we can get to some questions, that would be great.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Deborah Zavosek, and I'm here to testify in support of HF 45, authored by Representative Schultz, to establish automatic voter registration in Minnesota. Minnesota leads the nation in voter turnout. We are also currently the only state with a divided legislature, a fact that has not escaped national attention. I see this as a golden opportunity to set examples for the country on multiple fronts, not only in voter turnout, optimal access to the vote, and secure elections, but also in good bipartisan governance. 16 states and the District of Columbia have already instituted AVR. Preliminary results from Oregon, the first to enact it, show significantly greater voter registration and higher voting rates among previously disengaged populations. More data is needed, but it's clear that removal of barriers to voting at all phases of engagement is necessary for optimal participation. And AVR has additional benefits. Electronic transmission of voter data modernizes and streamlines the process, cleans up voter rolls, and saves money. The 2018 audit of the Minnesota State Voter Registration System showed voter fraud in Minnesota to be nearly non-existent, and implementing AVR would enhance security still further. Why would we not take all steps to ensure that our Minnesota elections are exemplary and our taxpayer dollars are wisely spent? Promoting full and fair access to the vote is not a red or blue issue. It's a democracy issue. Legislatures in red and blue and purple states have passed AVR bills, and governors of both parties have signed them. I'm encouraged that the list of co-authors of HF 45 is bipartisan. I hope the balance improves and spreads to the Senate. And I hope that legislators on both sides of the aisle and in both houses see this bill as a winning proposition for all Minnesotans. I have a PhD, too. It's not in number crunching, but I do have some numbers. Yes, Minnesota is first in the nation in voter turnout at just under 75%, but we trail eight other nations by as much as 12%, and the national rate trails Minnesota's by another 20%, putting the United States 29th in the world. There's important work to be done. It's January 30th. We have a divided legislature and less than 4 months to get the important work of the state done. We're in a bit of a spotlight here, not only for the polar vortex. Please pass HF 45 and other bills that set a Minnesota model of unity around common sense issues that move us all forward. And as an election judge, I'd also like to second the statements that have been made before about how much I would appreciate having this assistance with lessening the lines at the same-day registration tables. Now we have the electronic iPads, which make it better, but I'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll move into questions now. Members have questions. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify? Yes, we have one other testifier. Please come down. Please state your name for the record and proceed. And again, if you could keep your under 5 minutes so we can have some questions asked.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman, and good morning, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Lustico, and I'm the Policy and Outreach Manager at Growth and Justice, and I'm here today to testify in favor of House File 45, which implements automatic voter registration in Minnesota. Growth and Justice is a research and advocacy organization founded in 2002. And we believe that Minnesotans can unite around smart investments and practical solutions that build a decent standard of living and a vibrant democracy for all Minnesotans. Throughout the fall of 2018, we had over a dozen conversations with communities across the state about issues that matter to them. One topic present through every conversation was the need for an increased civic engagement opportunity. Automatic voter registration and the opt-out model does just this. It eliminates barriers and increases access, preparing all of our citizens to participate in the democratic process. We believe that automatic voter registration is good for broader prosperity and makes economic sense. Firstly, registering to vote can be cumbersome for some Minnesotans, specifically those with limited access to resources. Expanding civic agency to underrepresented communities at the polls encourages our elected officials to invest in economic development solutions that prioritize equitable outcomes for all Minnesotans. Also, enfranchising everyone into our democracy increases civic leadership. Communities with high participation of civic engagement typically do develop viable solutions that also benefit the economy. And as others have mentioned, modernizing systems and processes saves money. For our state, that could be invested in other areas. Several states that have already implemented AVR have reported cost-saving benefits. A healthy and vibrant democracy is directly tied to economic justice. It is critical that all Minnesotans are able to easily access their right to vote, and we as a state will do better when we utilize smart investments and systems to provide every person a voice at the table. Thank you for your time, and I urge you to vote in favor of House File 45.
And thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Any other members from the public who'd like to testify? If not, we will move into questions. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm wondering if we can hear again from the Office of the Secretary of State. Thank you for coming back down, Mr. Secretary. You mentioned that there are several steps kind of behind the scenes that maybe we don't get to see. And I had the good fortune of getting to tour the Dakota County elections offices anywhere they would let me go. There's places I didn't get to go either. To see kind of what the back end of voter registration really looked like. And there's a couple things that I noted. One is, we heard from the OLA report, we really do have a system of multiple checks for the integrity of elections. The other thing I was really impressed by is, much like us that sit around this table who want to be sure that every eligible Minnesotan who votes gets to vote and gets to have their vote counted, it was very clear that sentiment is shared by everybody who's working in that particular office, and we've heard it from your staff at your office as well. And so I'm wondering if you can just give us a little glimpse into the background of what keeps our election integrity intact, what systems go in place to check on the back end that the public might not get to see.
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Halverson, thanks for the question. You and the legislature over the decades have constructed a system that is multi-layered, that has many opportunities to check and filter and screen people. So one of the things that we do is our office runs the centralized statewide voter registration system, or SVRS. And some of you are on committees, including this one, where we discuss that system, the need for funding, some modernization of that system. So we are the keeper through that system of a lot of information, and it is regularly and routinely refreshed in a way that I'll describe in just a minute. So whether it's this bill or other ways of registration, take online voter registration. Again, I want to reassure people there's nothing automatic or computerized about it. It seems like that when you do a transaction, you know, on the internet and you register online, but I can assure you it's a very human process. It's not some artificial intelligence automatic deal. And so what happens is, and this is typically done at the county level, where they use our SVRS system, but it's done at the local level, at the county level. Dakota County is a good example of that. So if somebody registers to vote, obviously the first thing that a county will do is figure out, okay, is that person already in the system? And sometimes it happens, it's not uncommon, that someone will register to vote even though they're already registered to vote. Maybe they didn't remember, or they thought it had lapsed but it hadn't, or they didn't want to disappoint the college kid on the corner with the clipboard, so they signed anyway. But for whatever reason, the very first thing is, okay, is this person already in the system? If they are, no problem. Or maybe it needs to be refreshed and updated. Maybe they have moved. Let's say the person isn't in the system, brand new person, for whatever reason. Either they're in Minnesota and have never registered, or they just moved here from Kentucky, let's say. So then what happens is counties or local governments will draw from SVRS, which, as I say, is constantly refreshed. We subscribe to and have constant refreshing from multiple databases, state and federal. Everything from the Division of Vehicle Services at the Department of Public Safety to court data, because we need the court data on who are ineligible felons, and that is constantly refreshed, to death databases. We subscribe to two death databases. One is the Social Security Death Index, and one is the Minnesota Department of Health Death Index. Yes, there is such a thing, and there ought to be such a thing, right? We want to know, as morbid as it sounds, we want to know, you know, who has died for a lot of purposes, not just voting. So all of that is screened and filtered through those things. Then what happens? Then what happens is typically someone is mailed a non-forwardable card. It's a postcard. It's non-forwardable. Can't be forwarded. So if that card comes back, if and when it comes back, and there's always some percentages that come back, then there is no discretion. Local governments must try to resolve it. There is no, we're too busy. There is no, something else takes precedent. There is no, we just don't want to do it. They must. There is no discretion. There is no judgment call. They must track down the information. That can mean a number of things. It can mean phone calls. It can mean looking at other records to determine why did that card come back. And in the vast, vast majority of cases, there's an easy and obvious explanation. Sometimes it's just human error in Ms. Keating a number. Sometimes it's someone who has temporarily left their home. They had a forwarding order on their mail. Maybe they've gone into a nursing home temporarily for rehabilitation after an accident or a stroke or a health problem. And so they've had their mail forwarded. They haven't stopped living there, but temporarily for 4 weeks or 6 weeks, they're in another home, and that gets forwarded. But, of course, it's a non-forwardable card. So even though they've said, yeah, I'm going to be here at this particular facility for 4 weeks, have my mail forwarded, this card cannot, must not, shall not be forwarded. So it would go back to, in your example, Dakota County. So then what happens? So then after that, they must look into that information, either by, well, first they mark the voter as challenged, at least temporarily, on the roster, which means that if they ever did show up, they would have to provide yet another round of proof of two things. And this is the gold standard of Minnesota. The two things you have to prove to register to vote are you are who you say you are and you live where you say you live. Both. Not either or. Both. And Minnesota law is pretty forgiving about what you can use to prove those things. It's not just a driver's license. It can be a utility bill. It can be, in some cases, vouching from someone who lives in your precinct. So whether, and then if it's still not resolved, obviously that person won't, and that person can't show those two things, then they aren't allowed to vote. But let's say someone doesn't show up to vote, and someone at the county or local level tries and tries and tries through all means and methods to resolve a particular case. They still have a suspicion that someone is not lawfully registered to vote. Then what they must do, is refer it to law enforcement. And they do from time to time. And then that information gets reported to our office. There's an administrative rule in place empowered by a law that was passed a long, long time ago by the legislature. We just tweaked it over the interim with some new rulemaking. So now every year, rain or shine, doesn't matter, all the county attorneys, all the prosecutors in Minnesota must report to us. No discretion, no we're too busy, no we'll get to it later. They must report to our office the results of all such investigations. All. Not some, not most, all. And so we will be getting that report later on this year. I assume that they'll pertain mostly to the 2018 election, detailing what, if any, and they have to file a report, by the way, even if the answer is nothing. Every county, every prosecutor has to file a report with us, even if the report is a sentence saying we had no cases. So no one can infer that somebody just didn't get to the report. We have to have from all the county attorneys those reports, and then we can look at what they are and how the investigations were resolved, if they were resolved, if there was a decision to charge someone, if there was a decision to convict someone, if there was a conviction, what the conviction was. So I'm condensing a lot into that process, but it's a long process, and there are a lot of safeguards in place. And just, again, the risk of repeating myself, like I said before, the only thing that this bill changes is the first step of that multi-step process. Nothing else has changed. Nothing is more or less automatic. It's just shifting from an opt-in to an opt-out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Halverson.
And thank you for describing that background. I think that it's really important that we all have a really clear understanding. And I know that we've gotten to hear this from you, but there was a pretty extensive audit by the legislative auditor last year that seemed to confirm what you're telling us, that the system that Minnesota put in place, you used the word gold standard, I think that's a great word, continues to be strong and robust and work. So I just, if the Secretary wants to comment on that affirmation.
All I would say is we welcomed that OLA report. In fact, we're still dealing with them on one tail end issue that they want to follow up on. But we gave the OLA the keys to the car, so to speak. They came in and they wanted total access to the statewide voter registration system. I mean everything. They had unfettered, total control access to whatever they wanted. We didn't have to be in the room. They could have total access to every last scrap of data, every record, all the history. And I'm very pleased with what they came up with and what their conclusions were. Obviously, there's always room for some improvement, and they outlined some steps, number one of which I can't resist mentioning, the top of the list, the very first one was we need to recode and modernize our statewide voter registration system. And there's a bill, of course, pending right now to do that, which would enable us to have access to some vital federal funds in order to do that sooner rather than later.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't mean to sound like a squeaky wheel on a cold day, but for weather issues and other members of my caucus are not here, and so they've channeled their questions to me, and I'm going to share those with the committee today.
Thank you for bearing the load.
I had to step out to meet with some constituents who did brave coming down here today. And I'm just going to ask procedurally, do we have anybody from the Department of Public Safety testifying today? Because I see they are referenced in the bill.
I do not. Do we have someone? Yes, we have someone present if they'd like to come down.
Yeah, great. I'd like to ask them some questions if I might.
Please state your name for the record and then ask your question, Representative Driscoll.
Good morning. My name is Don Olson, and I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services at the Department of Public Safety.
Thank you for being here with us today, Mr. Chair, if I might.
Proceed.
On lines 1.20 through 1.22, and then it continues on to the top of the next page, state statute is being proposed to be modified where it says the Commissioner of Public Safety, in consultation with the Secretary of State, shall change the application for the original, duplicate, or change of address, and now it also includes instructional permit or identification card, and then it goes on. My question is, instructional permit, would that be akin to a driver's permit that someone who is age 15 or 16 or in situations of agricultural could get that as at the age of 14? Is that what that's referring to?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee,
instructional
permits is really a broad term. In some CDL classes, we also offer like an instructional permit for the before they actually, because they need time to test and time to practice. But I think in general, people do assume that's an underage permit before you get an official driver's license.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
So then my assumption is correct, but it's also more expansive than just what I had brought forward. Is that my understanding?
Mr. Chair and members, yeah, that would be correct, yes.
Okay. So currently on the application form, we were told that it's an opt-in versus an opt-out provision on here. So what does the language, do you have a copy of the card, or does anyone have, maybe the Secretary of State or the bill author has a copy of the current application so we can see what that language says on there? My concern is, does it say, I can't check this if I'm not eligible to vote? And again, I'm putting you maybe on the spot with that, but you're the only resource I have here today to be able to ask these questions before it sounds like we're going to vote on the bill today.
Ms. Holtz.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there is a block that they can check that said, I am eligible to vote. It asks a couple questions, qualifying questions on there. And I would prefer to just to provide you with what it says on the application, because I don't know it by memory, but I do know that the block exists to say I am eligible to vote.
Thank you. Could the Secretary of State come back, please?
Mr. Secretary, if you could come back down, please. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary Simon, one of the things that's extremely important at this point in the process, as you all know, is establishing legislative intent on what bills are intended to do and what we're looking at. And I would like you to comment and help to shape the scope on that conversation and those two words, instructional permit, as it applies to the 14-year-old in the agricultural environment or a 15 or a 16-year-old who is not eligible to vote. Because we have had bills that have come forward in the past that have said, hey, let's let 16 and 17-year-olds register to vote. Is this in any way, and I hate to use this term because it says a derogative sometimes connotation, a de facto way to be able to bring those individuals in? Again, I'm just trying to establish legislative intent, so if it goes in a different direction, we can come back to these and say, nope, Representative O'Driscoll, ask directly Secretary Simon what that means, and here's the answer to that question.
Secretary Stein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to clarify. But let me be crystal clear. Nothing in this bill, explicitly or implicitly, would allow anyone other than an 18-year-old to vote, or anyone who is not eligible to register to vote. That includes anyone of any age or any status. This is not a backdoor or de facto way to do any of that. That is not the intention of this language. And if additional clarifying language is needed by you or anyone else, Well, it's not my decision, but it's the author's decision. I would imagine that's something that could be drafted just to clarify, but it's no one's intention that I've ever heard to allow that to happen with this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, and Mr. I mean, Representative Driscoll, if you'd refer to 2.19 and 2.20 in this, it clearly states out the Secretary of State shall determine if the applicant is 18 years of age or older. As well.
Mr. Chair, I did read the bill, and I am very familiar with the language that's in there and the other accompanying language. That was what Representative Halverson had the Secretary of State review on that. I'm just wanting to make sure, because the next question, I think, is going to help shed some more light on that. So, Mr. Secretary, if I could, will your office be saying, golly, gee willikers, and maybe that's not the official term, but this individual is 17 and three-quarters years old right now who's applying for this. They may be eligible by the November election. Although they're not eligible to vote on the day that they apply, would you then include them in the system through the proposed bill, House File 45, that's being put forward by Representative Schultz, to then include them because they may be eligible by the next general election?
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll. No, this would not change. This would not move the needle 1 millimeter on current state law. If you aren't currently eligible to register to vote, you wouldn't be eligible to register to vote if this bill passed. This bill makes absolutely zero impact on the rules of eligibility in any way, shape, or form.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up with Secretary Simon on that. So maybe you could help the committee to understand what somebody who's 17 and three-quarters who would want to register to be eligible to show up in the voter poll, in the poll books, when they go to vote in their precinct. What would that process look like if someone's not 18? Could they pre-register at this point under state law?
Secretary Sen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, kind of a trick question. We don't have pre-registration in the state, but we do allow someone who is 17 and three-quarters right now under current law. This bill never sees the light of day beyond this committee. We allow that today as long as they don't vote earlier than that. But in terms of pre-registration of the kind that I think you're talking about, no, this bill would not accomplish that through other means. That's not the intent of this bill. This bill does not address or change in any way the current law eligibility standards on anything, age, residency, citizenship, felon status, anything, status quo.
Mr. Chair, if I might. So going back to the previous question, just again, to be using your term crystal clear on this, an individual who is 17 and three-quarters who is applying for a driver's license or other kind of learner's permit or something else, your office and the screening process would say, oh, even though they're 17 and three-quarters and they could have registered to vote in a alternative method, this system is not going to allow that person to be introduced into the system, assuming that they would be eligible as a citizen to vote in the next general election.
Secretary Stein.
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, I think I'm understanding your question. The answer is it wouldn't change current state law. So no one can obviously vote before they're age 18. People can, right now, under current law, register before they're 18, not too much before they're 18, but a few months before they're 18, if they're going to be 18 by the time of the election. That's current law right now.
So Mr. Chair,
Representative.
I'm going to try it one more time, Mr. Secretary. And pardon me if I'm not being clear on this. So if I am 17 and three-quarters and I could be eligible to vote in another method, or register to vote in another method, would this also allow me a vehicle in which to register, no pun intended, because I'm at the Department of Public Safety getting my driver's license or learner's permit? I would be able to check this box, automatically be able to be included because I would have been eligible under another method of the state, under state law?
Mr. Secretary.
I think I understand the question, Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll. The answer is yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Driscoll.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do have two other questions. Who would be helping with the programming on this as far as computers are related? I know that you and I previously were in another committee together.
Yeah.
We're talking about you hiring outside consultants to be able to help with this, and we would be using current state resources because your office is exempt from that.
Right.
Would that outside source still be using that, or would it be using a minute for those kinds of of activities? Because there are some sensitivities in the legislature as it relates to that particular agency right now.
So
Secretary
I heard,
Simon?
Mr. Chair, And Representative Driscoll, no, we don't use Minute, except for very basic things like, you know, very threshold things. We are totally in-house when it comes to that. So we would use our in-house resources as we do for other things. That can include from time to time, and has included from time to time, hiring outside contractors, but we do not use Minute. We're not a Minute integrated agency.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I do have one oral amendment, if you are open to that.
We will hear your oral amendment, Representative O'Driscoll.
On page 3 of the bill, section 3 talks about the implementation costs. It says that the Secretary of State's office must absorb any costs associated with the implementation of this section, section 2 rather, using existing appropriations. My oral amendment would be, since the Department of Public Safety would be working in concert with the Secretary of State's office, and since one area needs to absorb those, if we could insert after the words state and before after the word state and before the word must, and we would include this language and the Department of Public Safety. So both organizations that would be working on this would be treated the same way, that it would be funds that would be being absorbed off of current budgets on this. And that would be my oral amendment.
Thank you. I will phone a friend. And Mr. Secretary?
If I may, after conversing with staff members, they suggested, and they're right, that I ought to be even more clear than I was about the question that you asked, the last question, Representative O'Driscoll. So under current law, which would not be changed by this bill, if you're 17 and 3 quarters, you can process a voter registration. You are in a penned status in the system, so you're not actually registered. You're allowed to seek to be registered, but it doesn't kick in until your 18th birthday. So no one in Minnesota is actually registered before they're 18. You can apply for lawfully. It's not illegal if you're 17 and 3 quarters to fill out the form and say, please register me. You're in a penned status, P-E-N-D, in the system, and it's not until your 18th birthday that then that gets processed, and then our office confirms that you're 18. That's current law, absolutely unchanged by this bill, but I just wanted to be careful that I didn't imply that someone who's younger than 18 is actually registered. They can submit an application, and it's an append status.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Secretary, you've given me cause to think of something else on that same line. So that's a general election, a state general election. Recently, state law was updated to have 5 election days, 6 when you factor in township elections here in the state of Minnesota. So if a local government council member dies, mayor resigns, and they choose to go with an election option versus an appointed option, where would those voter poll books come from? Where would they be generated from? Would they be generated from your office for the local communities on that? And then that 17, three-quarter old individual, how would their status be on that local election versus a general election, aka a special election, which, yep, we, by the way, do have one pending here in the state of Minnesota right now, but that is a state election. Right. So my assumption would be that data would come from your office. But something that might be a local school board referendum, something that would be more to local jurisdiction, how would your office be able to screen to make sure that in this case that those individuals will stay in the PEND, the PEN status, as you testified to the committee?
Right.
Secretary Simon, just as a reminder, we're getting short on time here, so if we're going to get to your oral amendment, we'll have to sort of speed this up.
I'll be fast, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, thanks. Yeah, this is so the way the SVRS system works, it is really a cooperative thing. We house all the data, but the rosters, the lists, whether they're paper lists or an electronic form, those are generated at the local level by counties, cities, sometimes townships. So they would draw from the data that we keep, and we would be doing the filtering and screening in terms of who is 18 years old or not. And then they would draw from that in preparing their rosters. There are some jurisdictions where we propose the rosters, but generally speaking, the general rule is that they prepare their own rosters based on information they draw from out of the SVRS system that we run. That's the best answer I can give you.
Mr. Chair, last question, just for clarification. So somebody who's in the PEND, PEN status, would not show up on the voter registration roll or the poll books at that local level if they're drawing it down from the SVRS?
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, if the status in our system is penned, the status on the other end would be penned as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only other matter of business is the addressing of the oral amendment that I offered.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. And Representative Schultz, I'd like to ask, one, if you have any objections, and then, two, I also want to point out that we would also have to insert after the word secretary on line 3.9, the same language in the Department of Public Safety.
I would like to consult with the department before I would see this as a friendly amendment, but work with Representative O'Driscoll on its next stop and see if we can maybe possibly amend in the next committee hearing.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Well, the flip side of that is if it's not acceptable, we can take it out at the next committee level, too. This is the committee that I'm on that this has been brought to, and we're treating one source of funding differently than another. I'm just asking that we look at incorporating that, and if it's not acceptable, then it can be modified later instead of saying if it is acceptable that we would go, since this is the committee that the bill is in front of. And we are a division of the Ways and Means at this point, which is making this a finance-related matter, so I think it has jurisdiction in this committee today.
Thank you. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, since this is, dealing with state agency and state agency budgets, if Representative O'Driscoll has, is this a concern that was raised by the Department of Public Safety, or if Representative O'Driscoll has had a chance to bring this idea to the Department of Public Safety?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, we do have a representative here from the department. They certainly could comment on it, I would think, or they haven't come forward to testify one way or the other on the matter. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I just want to be clear. So it wasn't something the department brought. They're not having a budget concern with this particular bill at this time. That wasn't something that Mr. Representative O'Driscoll heard?
I don't believe so. I would... You know, if Ms. Olson would like to come down and just comment, I know that she was all bundled up, ready to go outside in the tundra. The question that I would put forward to you, Representative Driscoll, to consider at this time is, as we're moving this forward now, this seems to be becoming more of a substantial amendment, and oral arguments are not supposed to be substantial. So I would let Ms. Olson speak to this, and then we will let Representative Schultz proceed.
Sure. Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, could the question be repeated?
Representative.
Certainly. The gist, Ms. Olson, is that the Secretary's office has said that they would absorb any costs on this. I'm just asking that we would amend the bill to also say that costs that are associated with this endeavor would be absorbed by the Department of Public Safety. The way it stands right now, you could ask for an additional appropriation because it costs you money to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming there's not going to be a large cost because you're literally changing the way a printed form is. Staff time to sit down with the Secretary of State's office, it's minimal or non-substantial. Mm-hmm. My opinion, but I'm not within your department, so I would defer to you to see if it's diminishable or not.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we hadn't been asked yet to put a fiscal note together on this, and we understand the way the bill is written. However, this is programming changes because the data that we would be sending would be different, and so I would have to rely on our IT staff to give some estimate as to what those programming changes might be. However, we weren't listed in the bill as the one that had to come up with the funding for that. I understand, I think, that was left to the Secretary of State's office, so we would just have that conversation about what that would entail. Obviously, printing forms, those are things that are common to us, so we would observe those kind of things, as well as staff time to have those conversations and work in collaboration with the Secretary's office as to what those needs might look like.
Mr. Chair, based on that, then my question to Representative Schultz would be, have you requested a fiscal note to see what that's going to cost the Department of Public Safety, since they're being treated differently in your bill than the Secretary of State's office?
No, we
Representative
have not.
Schultz.
We have not. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing as how we're coming close on time, and I believe this is a pretty substantial oral amendment to this particular bill, I would request that you, Representative O'Driscoll, work with Representative Schultz as we move forward with this and before it is taken up in government operations. With that, any other questions or comments?
So what you're saying is you're going to decline the ability
yes.
to amend
yes,
the amendment. That's all I need to have is you just telling me that. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to just make a closing comment.
Representative Schultz.
I just want to thank all the testifiers for coming on this very cold day to support the bill. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Schultz, and I'd like to thank all the committee members who braved and made it in today. With that, we have Representative Halverson renews her motion for House File, where am I, 45, to be re-referred to Government Operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay.
No.
The motion carries. You're on your way. And with no other business, this meeting is adjourned.